Okay, let's get started. This study, well, you'll see in a few minutes, it's going to be a little difficult to talk about this particular subject. She entitles this essay, by the way, it's on Baha'alotcha, it's a reference to when you set up the menorah. When the menorah was set up and the lampstand was kindled in the tabernacle, there are a number of good lessons from this portion, and we've talked about them before, so if you want to look into the archive and avail yourself of a previous study, there's a lot of good things about this portion. At any rate, this essay is titled Thoughts While Stuck in a Traffic Jam. And she writes, 15 days left. That was a note on the fridge of a hardworking teacher, counting down until the end of her school year. My children, too, she writes, are doing a similar countdown. And I don't know if you've ever done a countdown like this. I still have a calendar, my countdown calendar from my last year in the Marine Corps, right? And what I did was I had a calendar, and each and every day I colored in the square. So this introduction hit home to me because I've done this too. At any rate, she continues, how often do we want to make time go away? Caught in a traffic jam, we fume about how long it is taking us to arrive at our destination. In a doctor's waiting room, we tap impatiently while awaiting our turn. Though our tapping and fuming doesn't make time go any faster, it expresses how we want to move on to the more important stuff. We enthusiastically await life's next milestones, the baby finally sleeping through the night, speaking her first words, walking his first steps, beginning that first day at school, only to wake up one day to an empty home, wondering where the time went. And I'm sure you've all experienced this as well. You know, one of the things that is sometimes said to parents with toddlers is enjoy it because very soon he's going to be asking for the car keys or she's going to be asking for the car keys. It sounds crazy, but that is in fact how fast it seems as though time flies. We enthusiastically await all of these, await the milestones. We talked about that one. We can't wait to graduate, earn our degrees, and begin our first job. Then we're eager for the next, better job opportunity until we find ourselves pondering when we will finally save enough to retire. When recording the life of righteous people like Abraham and Sarah, the Torah uses the phrase Ekanim Bayim Bayumim. They were old. They entered many days. And this, she makes a really good insight here. Another, again, one we've talked about before, but it's very appropriate in the context of this essay. If they were old, isn't it obvious that they had lived many days? In other words, the Torah qualifies the phrase, they were old, with the phrase, they lived many days. But to us, it's the same thing, right? But the wording implies, however, that living many days isn't necessarily entering our days. We can drive away our time looking for the next prospect, or we can live in the moment, entering each of our days by experiencing them fully. This expression, the last italicized sentence in this paragraph is incredibly important. One, I think, that we are all aware of. One that we have probably even talked about with our loved ones. But it's incredibly difficult to capture the mindset, or in Hebrew, the heart set, that makes this possible. We can drive away our time looking for the next prospect, or we can live in the moment, and that's what I'm referring to, living in the moment. What does it mean to live in the moment? Entering each of our days by experiencing them fully. The Jewish people had an unusual practice when they journeyed in the desert. Whether it was for 2 days, a month, or a year, that the cloud lingered to hover over the sanctuary, the children of Israel would encamp and not travel. When it departed, they traveled. At the Lord's bidding, they would encamp, and at the Lord's bidding, they would travel. Sometimes they camp for weeks at a location. Other times they remain for just a day. At every location, the Levites assembled the sanctuary, including the wall sections, the pillars, the tapestries, the furnishing, and every one of its hundreds of foundation sockets. Several thousand Levites were needed for this formidable task. Was it really necessary to assemble and disassemble the entire structure if they were to remain for only 1 day at a particular location? And of course, her response is yes. Because...
Let me end the video.
Because every one of our stations in life is significant. And this is one of the ways that the Torah emphasizes that. Every station in life is significant. At times we may feel that we are just at a waiting point, at a stage before the next, more important phrase. But every moment, every day, every moment, somehow, even those caught at the long supermarket checkout lines... You probably love them as much as me, right? If I'm in a checkout line with more than 3 people, I think to myself, how is it that the manager of this market isn't paying attention to the number of people in these checkout lines, right? Why doesn't another cashier come over and help out, right? Often they do, of course.
I've been waiting like 10 minutes for you to let me in.
Oh, often they do, of course, right? But the fact is that sometimes they don't, right? And so we wait there wondering how much longer we're going to be here. Every day, every moment, somehow, even those caught at the long supermarket checkout line can be entered into and transformed into an opportunity for growth, right? So the Lord is obviously still going to have to speak to me regarding... Right, how my wait in long checkout lines or DMV lines or in traffic or in any other similar circumstances can be transformed into an opportunity for growth. Okay? At every juncture, we need to assemble our own sanctuary by finding a way at this moment to join heaven and earth. So, as I was putting this study together, there were a couple of passages that came to mind. Both utilize the expression redeeming the time. Depending upon your translation, you wouldn't know that was true. So this is another occasion where multiple translations help us to appreciate what's actually being said. Particularly when a translation, tries to make it say something else, like here in Ephesians 5, verses 15 through 17. In verse 15, be careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. This expression in verse 16, making the most of every opportunity, as we will see, is probably what the phrase means, but the King James, the New King James, and the Young's Literal Translation all translate verse 16, redeeming the time because the days are evil. And there's a good commentary that explains what this means. In verse 16, the present participle of the word exagorazo, which is the verb in Greek for redeeming, is this in this verse is in the middle voice and refers to purchasing for oneself or for one's personal benefit on a continuous basis, right? It's one of the words that's used not only in Greek but in Hebrew. You've heard this. The word redeem means to purchase back, right? When God redeemed his people, he purchases them for himself, right? So this verb means purchasing for oneself or one's personal benefit on a continuous basis. And the voice in which the verb appears refers to this idea of continuity. It's not just something we do in a moment. It's supposed to be something that we do all the time. The days are evil. Paneros speaks of evil in active opposition to that which is good. If believers are not careful, the evil nature of this age will rob them of opportunities to do so, to do God's will. So, there are many other ways this passage is translated. The Complete Jewish Bible translates it. Use your time well, for these are evil days. Very similar to the NIV. And, idiomatically, it's a good way of translating this passage, although it doesn't quite... Whoops, sorry, there's Joseph. And Rivka and Beth Ann has joined us. It doesn't quite kind of carry the oomph that the word redeeming does. The MacDonald idiomatic translation integrates the idea or the meaning of redeeming. Be in the market to buy up time because the days are evil, right? So, in Greek, the context in which exagorazo is used is important because it can mean, for example, going to a market and buying up all the apricots that are there, right? Or buying up all the melons. It means to purchase, to buy up all that there is. At any rate, the New American Standard and the RSV translate it making the most of your time, because the days are evil. And notice that in a lot of these translations, like the King James, the New King James, the New American Standard, the RSV, the verb, in this case, making or redeeming, is the present participle. It's an ongoing sense of action. And the New Jerusalem Bible, make the best of the present time, for it is a wicked age. So, we are instructed here to redeem the time, not escape from it. And it always makes me mindful of these two passages, the one in Matthew 24 and John 17. When Yeshua says, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master, notice, finds him doing so when he returns," right? So when the master returns, it is best if he finds us doing. And of course, we never know when that's going to happen, right? So, the obvious conclusion with regard to this issue is that we should always be doing. Now, always be doing doesn't necessarily mean that we have to constantly be engaged in the work, right? We can also invest time in ourselves as well. And anything that facilitates our ability to be better at what we do, then that is something with an activity which is worthwhile engaging in. In John 17, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Yeshua prays, "My prayer," and he's obviously praying to his Father, "is not that you take them out of the world," his disciples. His objective is not to remove us from the world. His objective is that we might be protected from the evil one. We need to be in the world. We need to be the agent of change here in the world. This expression is also used in Colossians 4, and in the NIV, it is also translated idiomatically. So you would never know that the text actually says redeeming the time unless you look at another translation or look at the Greek. Be wise in the way you act towards outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Right? So the NIV translates this phrase the same way. Or redeeming the time. And of course, this is the way the King James and the New King James translates it. The verb in the statement, making the most of every opportunity, is a market term that meant to buy out, purchase completely. Exagorosa menoi. So Christians, as an expression of practical wisdom, and notice the spin that is put on it here. So Christians, and this is from the Expositor's Bible Commentary. Often the comments are very solid and very good. But in this case, this passage is used to drive an agenda. So Christians, as an expression of practical wisdom, must buy up and make the most of every opportunity for witnessing to the faith. So I obviously added the italics and the capitals. The fact of the matter is that this passage, when the passage is in the context of be wise in the way you act towards outsiders, make the most of every opportunity, that statement is understood in the context of evangelism, right? In other words, if you are in a supermarket line waiting for a cashier to get to you, you can use that as an opportunity to share with the person standing in front of you or standing behind you. Or if you're in a line at the DMV, right? Or if you are in a situation where you are waiting for anyone or anything, you can use that as an opportunity, right? In other words, every time you walk down the street, you encounter people that need rescuing. And of course, since you're the lifeguard, it's your job to rescue them, right? Unfortunately, this is not how evangelism works in the Bible. Evangelism in the Bible is relational, right? As for me and my house, it's relational. It requires a connection with people. It requires an understanding of what someone is going through, how someone thinks. I mean, unfortunately, Christianity tends to put the presentation of the gospel, the responsibility for a worthwhile presentation, on the presenter. Right? In other words, you just have to be able to say the right things in the right order, in the right way. But the fact of the matter is that the listener in Jewish thought is more important because every listener is in a different place. I don't know how many of you have ever done any public speaking, but one of the things that's incredibly important in order to be a successful public speaker has to do with your ability to read the audience, right? To develop a sense of where the audience is. It's not easy, frankly, to tailor your comments to the attitude or the place that the audience is at, but it's even more important when it comes to personal evangelism to have a sense of who it is that you're talking to. And of course, in a DMV line or a supermarket line, I mean, is it possible to strike up a meaningful conversation with somebody in one of those lines? Of course it is. Is that what typically happens? Probably not, right? Because the fact of the matter is, and it's even more true today than it was 30 or 40 years ago, the fact of the matter is that everybody is suspicious of each other, right? One of the things that I hate is commercials. Now, I know people who love commercials. And I have to admit that there are a few Super Bowl commercials that I've enjoyed. But for the most part, I don't like commercials. And the reason why I don't like commercials is because someone is trying to sell me something. But the fact of the matter is that I don't know these people at all. Right? So, I can't take at face value anything they say because their objective is to sell me something. And they don't know whether I even need it or not. Right? Now, if it was someone I had a relationship with and, you know, they were using a product that they, you know, discovered to be wonderful, and it turns out I was in a situation in which I, you know, needed something like that, and a trusted friend were to tell me about it, that would be different. But when it's someone trying to sell me something, it's like, you know, I don't know you from Adam. I maybe know you from a television program or from a movie, right? But I don't really know you. You're being paid to tell me that this product is good, right? How do I know? The fact of the matter is that that's the way evangelism works so many times. At any rate, Frank Abellin goes on to say, it may be appropriate at this point to recall the parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price in Matthew 13. The word translated opportunity is kairos, which essentially denotes a point in time in contrast to duration, which is the idea of chronos, another Greek word. Kairos, however, is sometimes used for significant time, God's time, an opportunity. And this appears to be the sense to be preferred in the present passage. So, my observation on this comment: for most Christians, making the most of every opportunity for witnessing to the faith involves a verbal testimony of the gospel. But that isn't what the text says. It says we should be redeeming the time, which is used in the sense of making full use of every opportunity. In what sense? In the sense that we need to be aware of the way we act in the presence of others, right? So it's not about verbally testifying, although there may be an opportunity or a time when that is appropriate. But the fact of the matter is that throughout the scripture, we are more frequently, much more frequently, encouraged to be concerned with the way we act in the presence of others, as well as what we say. And also, neither of the two parables cited have anything to do with witnessing to the faith, but both do have to do with buying out or purchasing completely, but in this case, the kingdom of heaven. That is, recognizing the great value attached to the kingdom of heaven. So you're familiar with these following passages. Matthew 5, this is the Sermon on the Mount, where Yeshua says, you're the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Right? People don't light a lamp and then put it under a bushel. Instead, they put it on a stand so it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, in this Matthew 5 passage, let your light shine before others. Right? Let your light shine. Let people see the real you, particularly in difficult circumstances that you share together, and then you will be given opportunities to identify what the source of your light is, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. And this passage in Matthew 6, don't store up for yourself treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves can break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, right? You are all familiar with these passages, all familiar with the idea of storing up for yourself treasure in heaven, being a light in the world, being the salt of the earth. These are things that we are all taught, we all know, right? The hard part is applying them, right? The hard part is living our lives in such a way so as to communicate these concepts and ideas in a broken world. And as I was preparing for the study, I came across a song by Tim McGraw. Now, I am not a country western fan, although there are some country western songs I like, and some country western singers I like, or maybe it would be best to say that I like some of their songs, right? But this one, this particular song, and hopefully after I read the words, you'll be inspired to listen to the song, because it's it really speaks powerfully to this issue with regard to redeeming the time. So this song is entitled, Live Like You Are Dying. This is a song he wrote for his father, after his father shared with him the news that he was very sick and probably wouldn't have the ability to do some of the things that he wanted to do in his lifetime. So, he said, is the way the song begins. I'm not going to sing it. I'm just going to say the words. You'll be happy that I'm doing this as opposed to the other. He said, I was in my early 40s with a lot of life before me. And a moment came that stopped me on a dime. I spent most of the next days looking at the x-rays, talking about the options, and talking about sweet time. I asked him when it sank in that this might really be the end, or this might be the real end. How's it hit you when you get that kind of news? Man, what do you do? And he said, I went skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu. And I loved deeper. I spoke sweeter. I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. And he said, someday, I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. He said, I was finally the husband that most of the time I wasn't. And I became a friend would like to have. And all of a sudden, going fishing wasn't such an imposition. And I went 3 times that year. I lost my dad. They went fishing together 3 times the year that Tim lost his father, but you can glean from the song that they had not been fishing together probably since Tim was a little boy, right? I finally read the good book, and I took a good, long, hard look at what I'd do if I could do it all again. And then I went skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu. And I loved deeper, and I spoke sweeter, and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. And he said, "Someday, I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying, like tomorrow was a gift. And you've got eternity to think about what you'd do with it, what you could do with it. What did I do with it? What would I do with it?" And then the song concludes with the refrain, "Skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu. And I loved deeper and I spoke sweeter. And I watched an eagle as it was flying. And he said, 'Someday I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. To live like you were dying. To live like you were dying.'" Now, on the website that contains the lyrics to this song, by the way, you can go to YouTube. You don't have to be a subscriber to YouTube. You can go to YouTube and listen to the song. And on one of the sites that contains the lyrics, there are responses to the song. And I wanted to read a few of these responses too. Hopefully they will speak to you as well. A woman named Sandra Smith writes, "When my husband and I were married, he told me that the doctor told him he would probably only live 5 years because of his heart. And I told him that we would have 5 good years together then. He listened to this song all the time, like many others have. He lived 12 years after we were married, 7 more than the doc predicted. We lived our lives as full as we could. Motorcycle riding, raising Great Danes, camping, and finally building a trike for him. This was an amazing song for my love, my husband, and my best friend. He took his ride with God in 2016. Since we needed more thunder, I miss him terribly. Thank you for this song." Another observation from someone designated as King Spoon Tunes. "My mama is 53 years old, and she has so many health conditions. I can't possibly list them here. We've been through so many tough times together. We're inseparable. I'm 17, almost 18, and these days I think I might lose her any day. She's finally got a doctor who's actually helping her. She hasn't always been the greatest mom, but she stepped up for me and my older sister in these recent years. It's something I'm grateful for every single day." And what's interesting here, of course, has to do with the fact that it is probably this woman's diagnosis that has caused her to step up for her and her older sister in these recent years. She writes, "I'm going to graduate in June, making me the first kid to graduate out of her 4. We sing this song together when it comes on the radio and she cries. It's one of her favorites. And honestly, it's one of my favorites now. I hope she lives to see how impactful she's been on her little girl. I want her to see all the success I do because of her. Hold your loved ones close, guys. Stay safe." Right? But of course, as this young woman writes, there's no way to know how much longer her mother will live and whether or not she will be around to see her graduate, right? And that is sometimes the position that we're in. James Utley writes, "Last night my best friend of 30 years told me he has terminal cancer and won't live to see another birthday. I'm at a loss and kept thinking of this song. Don't wait to do the things you always dreamed of, because tomorrow isn't promised." Right? Tomorrow isn't promised. All of us know this. We're all aware of the fact that tomorrow isn't promised. One of the things that we talked about when we studied Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers, is a saying of the sages, repent one day before you die. Right? But of course, it is not possible to know when you're going to die. So what are the sages actually saying? You know, figure out when you're going to die and save your repentance for the end. Is that what they're saying? No, obviously not. They're saying to stay close to God, right? In other words, to repent each and every day of your life so that there's nothing that obstructs your relationship with God. And don't wait until the end, because you don't know when that time will come. Do it every day, right? It's the sage's way of expressing the idea, redeeming the time, right? It's their way of expressing the exact same thing. Another one, this one by Copper Puppy. "My grandmother was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. And by that time, it was too late for any treatment options. From the time of diagnosis to when she passed away was approximately 1.5 months. To all of you who have lost loved ones to cancer, or anything for that matter, and for those of you going through rough times, my prayers are with you all." Unfortunately, this is the way pancreatic cancer typically works. It is difficult to say this and hard to believe, but a lifespan of 1.5 months after someone is diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer is not at all unusual. You know, if you go back to the words of the song, the very first paragraph of the song, he said, "I was in my early 40s with a lot of life before me, and a moment came that stopped me on a dime. I spent most of the next days looking at the x-rays, talking about the options, and talking about sweet time." Unfortunately, I remember when Dolores was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer too. She had experienced pain in her back. The doctor, of course, that she saw at first was not sure what was responsible for it. You know, you can have pain in your back directly opposite your abdomen, and it can be the result of many things, right? And so, of course, they try to decide what's the cause of it. And they start with the most obvious things and work their way to the least obvious things. And so she had many tests done. And one of the tests, an MRI, showed a very dark spot where her pancreas is. So the doctor immediately ordered her to have a CAT scan done. And, you know, these days when you have an MRI or a CAT scan, depending upon the facility where you have things done, they give you a disc of the CAT scan or the MRI that you can give to your doctor, right? So you're not limited as to where you can take it. A very close friend of ours, her daughter, married a pancreatic surgeon. And when we shared Dolores's diagnosis with her, by the way, Dolores was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, right? When she was diagnosed, we shared this with a friend. When she was told, or we were told, that you know, that the doctor suspected pancreatic cancer, we shared this with a friend who told us about her daughter that was married to a pancreatic surgeon, and she said the best doctor in the Bay Area, the best pancreatic surgeon in the Bay Area, is a doctor who works at Stanford, right? So, of course, we made an appointment to go to Stanford and to have him look at the CAT scan. So, we both went to the doctor's office. We sat there for a few minutes while we were waiting for him, and we had given the disc to the nurse before we went in, one of his assistants, surgical assistants. And he came in, and he walked over to his computer after saying hi and studied the CAT scan. He studied the CAT scan for about, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes. And Dolores and I were standing right next to him, looking at the CAT scan over his shoulder. And we were probably both wondering at the time how it is possible for him to look at this and to tell what it is that he's looking at, right? But as I mentioned, he had the reputation of being one of the best, if not the best, pancreatic surgeons in the United States, right? So we were both standing there, hoping against hope that he would say something kind, but he didn't. He turned away from the computer. He looked directly in Dolores's eyes, and he said to her, "You have 1 to 2 years to live. Put your house in order." And he said it exactly like that. "You have 1 to 2 years to live. Put your house in order." And we were both taken aback, of course. We were both devastated by what he said. And I mean, it was as if he reached into each of our chests and ripped our hearts out, right? Frankly, I'm not sure if that experience would have been any more difficult than the one we did experience. And so we were, you know, both at a complete loss for how to respond to that. So I asked him, "If this was your CAT scan, who would you see for treatment?" And he referred us to a doctor at UCSF, University of California in San Francisco. He referred us to their pancreatic care team that is the best in the West Coast, has the best survival rates among pancreatic cancer patients on the West Coast. And he gave us the name of the primary doctor and her assistant, who were both good. And as it turns out, we were able to get an appointment with that team within a couple of weeks of his pronouncement, of his, essentially his death pronouncement. By the way, I have known others with pancreatic cancer. I hope it's okay to say this, Joseph. Joseph's father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, as well as was his brother-in-law. And in both cases, they lived only months after their diagnosis. As it turns out, Dolores lived for 21 months. For 21 months. And I can tell you that in those 21 months, apart from living with the disease and the treatment for cancer, all of the, you know, all of the infusions and the pain and everything that goes with it, we did our best to redeem the time. That's precisely what we did. We made the most of every second of every day. And we were pretty good, I think, at redeeming the time prior to the diagnosis, but nothing like after it. It's a shame that this is what it sometimes takes, right? It's a shame that this is what it sometimes takes, but for better or for worse, this is what it sometimes takes. It would be great if it were to, if it were possible to tell you about this experience, right? Frankly, it's remarkable to me that Dolores lived as long as she did. I think she was pressing to be with me for as long as she possibly could, because she knew that it would devastate me, you know, when she finally passed on, right? So we did as much together as we possibly could, right? We, of course, looked into treatment options and looked into care and looked into facilities and did all of the things that you do. We both became experts in pancreatic cancer. We both came to know a great deal about pancreatic cancer. I even remember sharing with someone while I was sitting with Dolores, while I was sitting with Dolores, not with her, with one of her doctors, and explaining what the doctors had shared with us, and explaining what I was aware, or, you know, my understanding of pancreatic cancer, and this doctor, who was part of the treatment team, said, "Wow, you know, I mean, what you just shared, it sounded as if a doctor expressed it without, you know, all of the big words that make the explanation confusing, right? I mean, you come to learn a great deal about these things," which is what we both did. She became an expert, I became an expert. One of the hardest parts about it whenever she sensed that I was thinking beyond the 2 years, right? One of the things that happens immediately is that you stop making plans, right? You don't make plans to go away for the summer or to, you know, at the time we were planning to move to Israel. So we would go to Israel for a couple of weeks a year and look for places to live, right? So we stopped talking about moving to Israel, and we stopped talking about doing other things in the future, because you realize that you have no future, right? And whenever I slipped up and would suggest that we do something, she would always remind me that her care was palliative. In other words, it was not the doctor's objective to cure her of pancreatic cancer, because the kind of cancer that she had was not curable. 100% of the people who get this cancer die from it eventually. I mean, they all die, for the most part, within the first few months. Very few of them live beyond a year. Fewer still live to 2 years. And a very small percentage live to 5 years, right? But her cancer was inoperable, so nothing could really be done about it except for the infusions that she received. But she would always tell me that her care was palliative. It was just designed to make her last few months of life less painful, because it was incredibly, incredibly painful. And much of what we did was an attempt to help her manage the pain, right? But these are the kinds of things that go through your head when you're looking at CAT scans, when you're talking to doctors, when you're being treated by the medical team that's designed to help you with every aspect of your life, the way you manage stress, the foods you eat, the things you do, right? The time that you take for yourself. Redeeming the time becomes a very present reality. There's a few more of these statements. Let me read them too. I was in my early 30s and was told I would be dead by 40. I was in heart failure. Well, 20 plus years later, I am still alive. The heart is a mess. I am limited as to what I can do. It has left me disabled. But I frankly like this statement. But I will be damned if I will just roll over and let this kill me. Which was Dolores' attitude, too. She tried her hardest to stay alive, knowing that a cure or a treatment for her type of cancer could be discovered and employed. And, of course, she was a part of a group that was subject to, some experimental treatment, that had great promise. There are many pancreatic cancer treatments that show great promise, but so far, there is not a cure. I am grateful to God Almighty for making me unreasonably stubborn and making me stronger than I ever knew. This will get me eventually, I have no doubt, but I will fight to the bitter end. Alan Marcote. And last one from Cody Jacob. See, the reality is we are all dying. You never know when your last days will be, nor do you know what your last words, deeds, or thoughts will be. That's why every day truly is a gift, and you should cherish every second you have on this earth. You never know who you will inspire, whose life you'll change. Excuse me. Or what impact you have on other people's lives. Just give, love, and keep smiling. I apologize, I have a lid on. Tickle. A little tickle in my throat. I know we're at the time. I wish there was a way of impressing upon you, particularly those of you who have not had this life-changing type of an experience, to appreciate that we should not wait to do the things we've always dreamed of doing because tomorrow isn't promised. And one last thought. You know, in biblical times, there were three tithes, not one. The first and the second tithes were taken to the place that the Lord would choose to put his name. It's obviously a reference to Jerusalem. The first tithe was given to the Levites and the priests who served God. And the third tithe was called the poor tithe. It was taken in the third and sixth years and was gathered at the village gate and the storerooms of the treasury for the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. So there was a provision made for those who were not particularly fortunate in the community. But the second tithe was a tithe used to make one's pilgrimage journeys to Jerusalem. In other words, the tithe was used for you, right? It was a tithe that facilitated your ability to go to Jerusalem and to celebrate the feasts, right? And of course, these days we don't go to Jerusalem to celebrate the feasts. So, is that tithe irrelevant? Well, no. Like all of the instructions in the Torah, we can apply the principle of the tithe to our lives. And how do we do that? Well, we do that by setting aside funds that we can use to go to Jerusalem, to go to Israel, to explore the land, or that we can use to better ourselves, either to celebrate the holidays or to invest in ourselves and invest in who we are, right? Doing that, frankly, is a legitimate use of this second of the three tithes that existed in biblical times, right? So, obviously, today is about making the most of our time, being the person that God called us to be, and, you know, trying our best to take advantage of every opportunity that we're given to experience God's goodness in this life and experience it and to do the things that we've wanted to do as opposed to making excuses as to why we can't, right? So with that, I'm going to stop and ask if there are any comments or observations about what we've talked about. Anybody? Joseph, go ahead.
The song that you shared and the letters or the notes responses also reminded me of a line from another song, Cats in the Cradle.
Yeah.
they're not very, very familiar, but, you know, when you come in home, son, I don't know when, but we'll get together then, Dad. You know, we'll have a good time. We'll have a good time then. And, you know, I worked with my dad for over 30 years. So I saw him every day, but didn't necessarily talk to him every day, even though our offices were 10 feet apart, just because of the way the business was. I was busy doing my thing, and he was busy doing his thing. So there was days that we didn't talk. It was never because there was any animosity issues between us. It was so busy. But he got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And at the beginning, he was very confident that he was going to beat it. And as months passed and his weight continued to drop, you know, there was a realization on the part of myself and the rest of the family that it wasn't looking good. But I think because fortunately, he was never in pain, even till the week before he died. He says, "I've never been in pain." That I don't think he realized that he was deteriorating the way that he was. And one thing that he did say that I'll always remember, there's a couple of things. The last 3 or 4 months that he was alive, we spent a lot of quality time together almost every day. And that was wonderful. I'm glad for that opportunity. And he did mention that, he says, I thought I had a lot more to live. He died at 74. He was still mentally, physically very strong. And he said, I thought I had more time. And he told me, he says, don't wait to do the things that you want to do. Don't wait. But he also said, which I really thought was really neat, and I think it really helped him get through it. He says, you know, I thought I had more time. I would like to live more. He says, but I think in a sense, this is a blessing in that he says, I have an opportunity to make peace with God and people as opposed to if I had had a heart attack or gotten in a car accident, I wouldn't have a chance to say my goodbyes and make peace and so forth. So yeah, I don't want to go. I'm not ready to go, but I have an opportunity to say my goodbyes and make peace and put, like you say, put my house in order. So I think that perspective helped him. It made it easier for him, and I think it made it easier for myself, and I believe, you know, the rest of the family also. So, anyway, I just wanted to share.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I knew Joseph's father pretty well, too. It was a very difficult time. Weight loss is one of the things that pancreatic patients have to really struggle with because they eating isn't very important for them. When Dolores passed away, she weighed 79 pounds. She was 63 and 79 pounds. It was very difficult to watch that happen to her. But, like Joseph just said, and his father, Joseph, said, that the time he had gave him an opportunity to, you know, to put his house in order, to get things together, which is what happened with Tim McGraw's father, too, right? I don't know what kind of cancer he died from or how long he lived after he was diagnosed, right? But he says, as in the song, I loved deeper, I spoke sweeter, I gave forgiveness, I've been denying. Right, so he obviously had a chance to do some of those things too. There are several chats. Let me just look at them very quickly. From Ed. Thank you. This lesson was on point and timely. My lady and I had the moment when she shared that she had days, 2 weeks to live. It turned out to be days. We made lots of plans for the coming years. And while she and I had a pretty full last few months, it wasn't enough. I value time much more now and have been doing and planning to use what time I may have left to live it fully and well. Thank you. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate the comments. This is a very difficult lesson to learn. From Watina, thank you for sharing your story and a great study. From Elaine, thank you. This was a great study. Thank you for sharing your story. Ed, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you, Joseph, for sharing your dad's story. From Rivka, comfort prayers for all who have lost loved ones too early, and that includes Rivka, who has lost loved ones too early as well. From Latina, thank you for sharing your story, Joe. And from Dave and Amy, thank you, Bob, for sharing. Very good. Any other comments before we go? By the way, that song, Cat in the Cradle, expresses something similar, although from a different perspective. This was a boy who grows up with a father who is never around, right? And his father was always too busy, occupied with other things to give his son any real attention, right? Until, of course, his son grows up and the father realizes what he sacrificed and tries to rekindle a connection with his son, right? But by then, it's too late, right? And that's the saddest thing of all, when it's too late. When it's too late to make the changes we have such a heart to make, right? That can be a very difficult experience to struggle with, too. Anybody else before we go? Yeah, Tina, go ahead.
Your story just reminds me of my mom when I was taking care of her, and she was diabetic, and which led to like kidney failure and all kinds of other health issues. And I was able to help her get a transplant, and there was even complications with the transplant. And because I was the translator and the caregiver, I too became an expert in the transplant world. And she passed when she was 56. And I just felt like I didn't have the time that I wanted with her. And, you know, she never got to meet James.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm also struggling right now, you know, with this taking, you know, making the most of the time. So a couple of weeks ago, Steve and I, we found out that I was pregnant, but I've miscarried. Just yesterday, so I was at the doctor's office, and this is actually our second miscarriage. And so I just feel like I've lost a lot. And
yeah.
I spent time, you know, right now I'm struggling because, you know, the doctor said I should just take the next week off. But there's a part of me that's like, I should just work because I want to get my mind off of it. But, I don't know.
I'm so very sorry, Tina. You know, unfortunately, there's no right way to deal with it. For some people, taking time off is helpful, and for other people, working through it is helpful. My daughter has had 3 miscarriages in the last year and a half. She also happens to be 40, right? So just because of the way medical care works, you know, it's not uncommon for a woman to have a miscarriage. So they don't explore the reason why until you've had 3. When you have 3 miscarriages in a short period of time, then they run tests, which they did with my daughter, and they discovered a condition that is relatively easy to treat, right? But the fact is that she's over 40 now. So she and her husband are struggling with whether or not they should even try to treat it and to get pregnant again. And of course, there's, you know, no guarantees. But it's incredibly painful. They have 1 child who's now 4, you know, and they were hoping for a little girl. Not that they would have gotten one, but they were hoping for a little girl. And it's hard to know what to say. I'm just so very sorry.
I appreciate you listening.
Yeah. I know. My father was also diabetic. He never took the diabetes very seriously. He eventually had to have one of his legs amputated and was never the same after that. And he actually passed away a few weeks after the first procedure. They amputated his leg up to his knee, and then they had to remove the rest of the leg up to his thigh. So he only lived a few weeks after the second procedure, where he just was never the same. And I mean, it was, I don't want this to sound callous, but you've heard of that expression, the lights are on but no one's home. That's the way it was with him at the end, right? He just was not the same person. Right, so it made quality time with him very, very difficult at the end. Right? I mean, I saw him many times, but it was like he was already gone. Yeah. Life can be very difficult sometimes. And it's that's why this notion of redeeming the time is so very important, right? And, you know, I just pray that all of you are aware, of course, of the fact that we learn best through our own experiences, right? Hopefully, in this case, you will not have to experience the death of a loved one, you know, to appreciate how important redeeming the time is. From Cassandra, thank you all for sharing. Big hugs. Thank you, Cassandra. From Beth Ann, what a moving and inspiring study. Thank you all who shared your stories. Loss is hard. Prayers for all of us who have lost loved ones. So, sounds like Beth Ann is in that category or in that boat as well. From Dave and Amy, may you all have shalom this day, for he will wipe every tear from our eyes. From Beth Ann, thank you, Tina and your husband. Praying for you, Tina, and your husband in your loss. And from Charlene, praying, Tina, for you. From Bonita, I am so sorry, Tina, for your loss. You will be in my prayers. From Latina, sorry for your loss. Tina will keep you in my prayers. From Tina, thank you, everyone, for all of your kind thoughts and prayers. Hugs to all. And from Elaine Kirkland, I'm praying for us all that have suffered loss. My daddy, God, bring shalom to us all. Amen. And from Ed, I'm so sorry, Tina. My prayers are truly with you, and I am hurting for you. There is never enough time with the ones we love. By the way, one thought. One of the things that made this so difficult for my daughter at the time that this was all going on was she thought that the miscarriages were her fault. For that entire time, they were, of course, elated to discover that she was pregnant, and then devastated to discover that there had been a miscarriage. And she felt very guilty that it was somehow her doing. Right, so that made it very difficult. So, in some ways, it was a relief for her to discover that she had nothing to do with it, that it was a condition. Right? So, I don't know if that is an issue that you're struggling with, but...
Unfortunately, it is. I think that it was something that I may have done. Something I may have ate. Maybe I shouldn't have exercised when I thought it was okay to. I don't know. You have all these thoughts.
Exactly, which is precisely what she thought of too, you know. But you know, frankly, exercise is a good thing. So the reason why I shared that is because I wanted you to know that these things happen for a variety of different reasons, and it wasn't your fault. I know that's hard to hear, because it means the reason escapes you, right? It's easier to believe it's my fault. Then I can blame someone. But you're not to blame.
I'll keep that in mind. Thank you.
Very important. You are, you know, these things, they happen sometimes for a variety of different reasons, none of which makes sense frequently. The name of the song was Live Like You Are Dying by Tim McGraw. Live Like You Are Dying. And like I said, you can go to YouTube. I mean, there's plenty of ways to listen to it these days. But you can listen to it on YouTube. Okay? Any other comments before we go?
I just wanted to comment. I think one of the first things in listening to, you know, everybody's stories and just through the lesson and just looking at, you know, this last experience that we've been having with Wanda, it's so hard when you feel helpless to change or help the person. Not hopeless, but helpless.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, you feel like you're feeling what they feel. And it's, you know, it's one of those things of being able to kind of just let that go. You know, where you realize that you really put it in God's hands. Because you can't do anything. As a lesson.
Yeah, it's an important lesson, but a very difficult lesson to learn, right? Because we all think that we have the capability of making things better, and we don't. You know, we can make someone who is suffering with something more comfortable, or, you know. You know, I was with Dolores at every doctor's appointment, every hospital visit. You know, I mean, you know, you do what you can do, but that's the hard part, is ultimately the person goes through whatever they go through alone. That's when you realize, as you mentioned, that, you know, the feeling of helplessness that you feel is because you are helpless. Right? That's the hard part. And because we love someone so much, we just want to do something, anything, to help, you know, help them feel better. You know. Very hard. There's another couple of comments. Beth Ann asked regarding Wanda. Wanda is doing better. She had to go back to the hospital this week to have her gallbladder removed, which didn't have anything to do with the spinal surgery, just another complication. It had to be addressed. So she's doing well. Apparently she's doing better now. From Dave and Amy, we had several miscarriages, and we also asked the same thing. Is it our fault? We prayed and hung in there, and he blessed us with 11. So we are praying for you and your family. From Dave and Amy. So I'm not sure if that means, Dave and Amy, that you have 11 kids, but maybe. From Rivka, Seasons in the Sun is the song when I lose a person. Condolences to Ed as well. I didn't know. Yes, Seasons in the Sun. I don't remember who does this one. But Rivka, if you can let us know who that's by. Yep, condolences to Ed as well. From Tina, thank you, Dave and Amy. And Dave and Amy say, yes, 11. So they have 11 children. So the Lord definitely made up for those. Very good. From Ed, thank you, Rivka. 6 girls, 5 boys. Wow. An understatement to say a handful. Well, it's nice even split, though, for the most part. So that's probably good. From Ed, wow, that is a blessing. From Elaine, Dave and Amy, your quiver is full and blessed. Yeah, definitely true. Very good. Okay. Other comments before we go? From Dave and Amy, not easy though. No, I can't imagine having 11 children is easy. Okay. Well, very good. I guess if there are no other comments or questions, we'll say Laila Tov or good evening. May the Lord be with you. So, Michael, enjoy the Northwest, and Elaine, enjoy Bermuda. And it's always good to see everybody. May the Lord be with you and keep you. God bless. Until next time. So we'll keep each other in prayer. That would be great, okay? Nice to see everybody. Have a wonderful what's left of your Shabbat. And have a good week, okay?
Thank you. Shabbat shalom. Lala Tov.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Lala Tov to everyone.
Oh, it's from Terry Jack. Season in the Sun. Terry Jack. Very good. God bless you guys. Bye for now.
Bye-bye. God bless you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Bye for now.
God bless everyone.
You guys have online church?
Record.